350 years ago this week, the very first of these was born. The Royal Society had been founded a few years earlier by luminaries of science such as Newton, Robert Hooke, Christopher Wren, but it was its secretary, Henry Oldenburg, who drew together various letters and reviews into the world's first scientific journal, still running today, fondly known by the scientific community as PhilTrans, or to give it its full original title,
Philosophical Transactions, giving some account of the present undertakings, studies and labour of the ingenious in many considerable parts of the world.
And henceforth, Inside Science shall be known with the same subtitle. Good luck with that, Radio 4 continuity announcers. Many journals these days are slowly transitioning from unwieldy and chunky monthly magazines to online super-enriched articles these days. Science historian Dr. Aileen Fife told me what the original science journal looked like.
A monthly news sheet. A small, slim thing, relatively cheap. It didn't look like a ponderous, fat, staid kind of scientific journal.
And of course, the Royal Society was formed by some of the great names from the history of Western science. But this contents page from 1675, from across the year, is this just incredible litany. People like Newton, Boyle, Van Leeuwenhoek. The range of topics covered in these early editions is just astonishing.
It's very true. And the early readers and contributors to Philosophical Transactions were interested in all sorts of different things.
A letter concerning a new way of curing sundry diseases by transfusion of blood. The project of causing the blood of a healthy animal to pass into the veins.
They're interested in Leeuwenhoek looking at the blood. They're interested in the air pump. They're interested in orange trees. They're interested in a report from Paris about how to make trees grow bigger and stronger, which is all to do with the equinox and the full moon and stuff, which they realise is perhaps improbable, but it's worth putting it out there just in case somebody wants to test it and there might be something in it. They'll put out things that might be of use to people. He's got another one later on in the same issue of 1675, where Martin Lister, from a physician in York, reports that one of his correspondents has told him about children vomiting worms. So he sends a letter.
With some relations concerning odd worms vomited by children, etc.
There's even a picture of the worms.
Charming.
So you're seeing a huge range of things they're fascinated in that maybe nowadays wouldn't make it into print. But back then, maybe some of this will be useful to somebody. Maybe someone will investigate it. It's a very different attitude, by the way, from the French, who wouldn't publish some of this stuff in their equivalent journal, because they only publish stuff that they've actually tested and replicated. In England, the Royal Society will publish anything that seems interesting and perhaps plausible.
And what sort of papers are they publishing? Because it's quite a broad range. This really is the beginning of science.
So they're publishing all sorts of things, but they're not really publishing papers in the sense that you might think of it, because virtually everything you're looking at in 1675 was compiled, collated, extracted or translated by Henry Oldenburg. It's not that people are sending papers to him. It's that he's looking at his correspondence, he's looking at the new books that are published, he's looking at what happened at Royal Society meetings, and he's putting together content. In terms of the sort of stuff that's in there, we're seeing Leeuwenhoek's work with the microscope. There's some discussions of Isaac Newton's work on optics, first published 3 years earlier. But there's also, a great title, I think, Phytological Observation Concerning Oranges and Lemons, both separately and in one piece, produced on one and the same tree at Florence.
The language is very charming now. I love the fact that they refer to Cassini as the excellent Cassini, which makes him sound a little bit like a magician. There's one that jumps out, January the 1st, 1675.
Of the incandescence of quicksilver with gold, generously imparted by B.R.
And it's anonymous. Who is B.R.?
This one's fun. This B.R. is actually a reversal of the initials of Robert Boyle. But here, because he's writing about alchemy, which is something secretive. It's not something you share with everyone. It's something that is potentially powerful knowledge, and also something that maybe doesn't quite fit with Boyle's usual reputation as a man who works on chemistry and air pumps and such like things. Here he's writing pseudonymously. I think quite a number of people would be able to guess who B.R. was.
Yes, it's not the greatest of disguises. But let's jump forward to an issue that you've pulled out from 1901. Now, what was it about 1901 that is a useful comparison to those very early editions?
I chose 1901 because it's got a paper by a woman in it, and there aren't very many such examples, though there are a few others. But This is a fun issue, I just thought, because there's a lot of very eminent work here. We've got articles here by Ernest Rutherford, who's going to go on to win a Nobel Prize a few years later. There's a whole range of really quite eminent physicists in there. And yet you've also got Alice Lee writing about intelligence and human skull size. And you've got Francis Penrose writing about the astronomical orientation of Greek temples. It's much more like a modern scientific journal. These are all research papers. But we do still have the bit about Greek temples, which is kind of fun.
But you've mentioned Alice Lee. What was the frequency of female authors in Philosophical Transactions around this time and through its history?
Well, the 1890s is when we're starting to see some women publish. There were a couple of examples before that. Caroline Herschel was the first, and then Mary Somerville in 1826. And then, as far as we know, nobody until 1887. And then there's a whole range.
So even though women were being published in these journals, it wasn't exactly a level playing field. They still had to have special dispensation to get in.
So did anyone who wasn't a fellow of the Royal Society. If we look at Caroline Herschel, who is the first woman published in Philosophical Transactions, she wrote a letter to the Secretary of the Royal Society in 1787 announcing a new comet. She is able to do that because her brother is already well known to the Royal Society. This is William Herschel, and he happened to be away in Germany at the time when Caroline Herschel happened to see this comet. And so she took the liberty of writing to the person she already knew through her brother. And so it's a slightly unusual case that she's passing on news through her correspondence network, and that then ends up being published in Philtrans. Whereas by the 1890s, you've actually got some women who are having careers in science, just starting, especially at Newnham or Girton at Cambridge. And some of them are now starting to get published if they've got support from, say, their supervisor or a senior colleague.
Aileen Fife from the University of St Andrews. An exhibition curated by Aileen of 350 years of staggering science is at the Royal Society in London until the 23rd of June. And it is marvellous.